that shall go before us. As for this Moses, we wot not what has become of him. Now it's very interesting that they go and do this to Aaron, and I guess they didn't decide to do it while Moses was down there because they knew the reaction. But Aaron seems to be a weak leader in comparison with his brother Moses. Some things that make Aaron weak, first of all, he gives in to their suggestion, right? And it's almost like he's like, he goes, you know, he starts giving them advice for it. He's like, okay, break off your earrings, let's go ahead and do this. So he gives in to what they say. They break off their earrings, they put them in the fire, and he fashions a calf. And they begin to worship the calf and to say, these be thy gods which brought thee out of the land of Egypt. Where do you suppose they got the calf, the idea of a calf? Maybe from Egypt, right? They did have one along that line. But it's interesting that even Israel, not surrounded by neighbors that worshipped other gods, they've seen all these works and wonders of God, and here they are assembled by themselves at Mount Sinai. Even then, they're able to commit idolatry. So sometimes we think, well, if we can just keep the world out, that we won't have a problem with sin. But that's not necessarily the case. Remember, Jesus was alone in the wilderness when he was tempted.
These people, this is what they lived with. They grew up with this. They were born. This is what was going on around them. The people they worked for, this is what they did. So that they didn't know anything else. Seriously. You know.
Right. But you think about all
and they didn't have the laws that Moses was still getting. They didn't even hear any of that stuff yet.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not right, but it's just, I can understand why they did what they did.
However, if you do look at all the signs that God had given to them, certainly. But, you know, that's the way it's always been. People ask for signs, and even when God has given signs, people are quick to forget, quick to cast God out of their mind. So, Aaron shows that he's a weak leader. When Moses comes down from the mount and asks Aaron what happened, now he's not really inquiring for information, but he's giving a rebuke to Aaron. Aaron says, well, you know the people. You know how they are. And so he tries to shift the blame. So there's a lot of things that Aaron does here as far as not standing up, shifting the blame, not taking responsibility for himself. Remember, he said, well, I put it in the fire and out came this calf. Now, that would almost be, it is comical if it weren't such a serious sin, right? So all of these kind of contribute to Aaron being a weak leader. On the other hand, Moses is shown to be a strong leader. You know, he had, first of all, a strong reaction to sin. He came down there, he was angry, right? Now, when he came down from the mount, Joshua was there and heard the noise and said, well, it must be a war. And Moses said, it's not the sound of war, it's the sound of singing. And so he goes in and the people are worshiping the calf, and they're eating and drinking and playing and all of that. And so Moses is so angry that he throws down the tablets, and they break. And he takes that calf, and he grinds it to powder, and mixes it with that water that came from the mount, and he makes the people drink of it, right? So, first of all, he has a strong reaction to sin. Second of all, he disciplines the people. Good leadership involves discipline, right? Good leadership also places the spiritual over the physical. If you're going to have a leader that's just going to favor family ties, that wouldn't be good. Did Moses do that? No. Certainly not. He held Aaron responsible, and he was upset with Aaron. Just because Aaron was his brother didn't mean that he was going to give him any favor. And he also is willing to have compassion on the people and go to God and pray for the people. And he was even willing to sacrifice himself. He said, Lord, blot me out of your book if you won't forgive them of their iniquities. He does that in his intercession that he gives for God. So leadership like that is needed today. Think about the qualifications of elders. Titus chapter 1, 1 Timothy chapter 3. They're supposed to be people that will hold fast to the word, that will be able to convince the gainsayers. They're to be people that can stand up against sin, and they're to be people that can feed the flock, people that are watchful. Hebrews 13, verse 17, they watch for your souls. So all of the qualifications there really lend themselves to somebody that's going to have compassion on the people, but is also going to stand for truth and be serious about sin and do what's necessary to make sure that people don't go astray. So Moses is the good example there. Aaron is kind of a weak or bad example. Now I want us to consider a little bit about this idolatry that they involve themselves in. We've done it a little bit so far, but the question I want to ask is, why idolatry? I think we've given a little bit of an answer. They do kind of grow up with that around them, right? That's the second one I have down there. I mean, everybody else is doing it, right? But it's interesting to me, they don't just say, well, there's no God whatsoever, let's just do anything. They have to make themselves a God. And it's interesting, they say, let's make ourselves a God, isn't it? The very idea that you're making it, which later on, you know, Isaiah would make and Jeremiah would make arguments along that line that you know, you're fashioning it yourself. But I think maybe it lies in this, in the fact that they at least had a higher power to worship that wasn't as restrictive. Aren't people very similar in their approach to God today? I mean, the great majority of people say they believe in God today, right? But when you start defining God by what the Bible defines Him as, you find very much fewer people believe in the God that the Bible reveals, right? For instance, if you say, well, God is a God that's going to punish the wicked. God's a God that, you know, that will do that. Well, a lot less people believe in that. Or God is a God that created the world. You know, whatever it is that people are offended by, they'll kind of cast that out. And so it's interesting to me, at least they have some power. They can say, well, at least we're worshiping a higher power, but it's not as restrictive as God is. And so even though we can say, well, how in the world could they give themselves to idolatry? In a lot of ways, people do that today. They redefine who God is. And the giving their affections to another God. Whenever you divide your heart up, your heart is supposed to be given completely to God. He wants all of your heart. Whenever you divide it up to something else and give affection to something else, it's spiritual adultery. You know, Ezekiel talks about this, and other of the prophets, Hosea, give this image of spiritual adultery, where you're supposed to give certain affection to God and you're giving it to somebody else. Wasn't it interesting what they said about this false god? They said that it did what? Brought them up out of Egypt, right? So they attributed the things that they had been given by God to somebody else. Where do you think they got those earrings that they had? Wasn't it when they spoiled the Egyptians, which God gave them favor in the sight of the Egyptians? So everything that they had was from God, which is pretty obvious, but it's interesting. You take all of that and then you attribute it to somebody else, and that's part and parcel of idolatry. It also degrades the people. If they're worshiping an animal, don't be surprised if they start acting like animals, right? Now, I don't know exactly all that was involved in this. Israel became involved in fornication. I do think the word play there has that connotation. I don't know beyond any shadow of a doubt. I know at least it was idolatry, according to 1 Corinthians 10, verse 7. But it might have had, if it was a worship of a god of fertility, it might have had that involved in it. And so, whatever it was degrading the people. They let loose, so to speak. If you look at what the Bible says there, the fact that it says that people were naked, not in the sense that they were unclothed, but more in the fact that they were unbridled. Verse 25, they had just kind of thrown off all restraint. This is what they had done. And so it causes people to go in a downward spiral, so to speak. And the first thing that has to happen is people have to forget God, right? Consider Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1 talks about this spiral, this, you know, this fall that the Gentiles had into moral chaos. And it all started with the fact that they didn't glorify God. When they knew who God was, they didn't glorify Him as God. Neither were they thankful. They weren't thankful for the things that God had given them. They didn't acknowledge God in their mind. And as soon as somebody casts God out of their mind, there's no telling how far they're going to fall, right? That's the first thing that Satan did with Eve, right? He got her to not focus on what God had commanded, but focus on her own interests. And then at that point, he could undermine God's motives for giving the command and everything along that line. So when you cast God out of your mind, then you can sin more comfortably. You're on the throne, and you can do what you want. And how quickly these people forgot, right? I mean, he'd only been up there 40 days, right? And so it was a very quick departure. And we find things in the New Testament of people falling away quickly. Recently we had a class on Galatians. They were so soon removed, you know, from the true gospel. It can happen quickly when somebody forgets God. Now, look at how Moses intercedes for Israel. Before he comes down from the mount, Moses appeases God's wrath. And he gives different reasons or tries to remind the Lord of certain things. Now, I think the Lord obviously was cognizant of these facts, but what I'm saying is Moses was pleading with the Lord. He tells the Lord, listen, these are your people. There's a special relationship that we have. The Egyptians will no doubt blaspheme. They'll say, well, he destroyed them because he couldn't bring them into the land of Canaan. And then number three, he tells God, or pleads with God to remember his promise to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and fulfill that. And all of this he did after God says, I'll destroy this people and I'll make out of you a great nation. He gives the same offer later on in Numbers chapter 14 when the people lack faith, you know, and they those 10 spies give that evil report. And isn't it interesting that Moses refuses that and pleads on behalf of the people? Now, doesn't that show you some reasons why God chose Moses to be a good leader? Because he had compassion on the people? Doesn't that point you towards Christ having compassion on the people, right? That's why he was such a good intercessor going to them on behalf of them, because he really did have compassion for the people. Now, in his second approach to God, verse 30 of this chapter, he goes to them and he says, I want to go pray to God. Perhaps we will get some atonement. So even though he'd appeased God's wrath, this one was kind of an approach, a request for atonement. He confesses that they sinned. He's asked for forgiveness. And he says, and if you forgive them not, I ask that you blot my name out of your book. And so I think this is kind of the idea of wanting to be a substitute for them. Now, does God allow that? No. God says, I'll blot out whose name I'm going to blot out, and I'll keep whose name I'm going to keep in there. What book is this? Probably the book of life that we read about in the New Testament. Several times you read about it in the book of Revelation. Right? Those people that are not found written in the book of life, they're cast into a lake of burning fire. The fire and brimstone, Revelation 20:15. So the book of life mentioned Revelation 3:5, Revelation 17:8, also mentioned in Philippians chapter 4, I think. And so book of life is those that are saved. So, but God says, no, I keep that, and he can't be a substitute for the people. But he tells Moses to go ahead and deliver the people, lead them like he has been doing, and he'll send his angel before them to fight them. He'll still deliver them into the land, but he did plague the people because of their sin. We, up until this point, we really haven't seen any repentance on Israel's part, have we? I mean, they've been disciplined by Moses, but really we haven't seen a repentance. And so you can see why, you know, God is still angry with them and is going to give some punishment. Now, there was some other punishment that happened just besides the drinking of the water. 3,000 people died, right? The Levites were charged to go and kill every man that was not on the Lord's side. Now, Moses, one of the reasons why he was a good leader is he called for some action. He says, you make a decision right now. Kind of like Elijah, how long halt you between two opinions, right? Here Moses is saying, tell me who's on the Lord's side. And then he says to the Levites, go out and slay every man his brother and every man his kinsman and companion. And about 3,000 people died that day. We contrasted that with the 3,000 that were saved in Acts chapter 2 when the new covenant was given. I don't know if there's any lesson that the Bible's trying to teach us in that, but it is interesting that the first covenant was accompanied by death and the second covenant was accompanied by spiritual life. Now, in this next chapter, in chapter 33, the Lord meets with Moses and he commands him to take these people up from Sinai. And where he meets him is a place called the Tent of Meeting or the Tent of the Congregation. Now, you've got to be wary of something. Later on, the tabernacle itself is called the Tabernacle of Congregation in the King James Version. In chapter 38, verse 8, when they're putting those things in there, it's called the Tabernacle of the Congregation. But this tabernacle, or this tent, is not that. It is a tent that Moses set up outside of the camp. And do you think there's some significance to the fact that the tent that Moses is setting up at this point is outside the camp, rather than surrounding the people or in amongst the people? What did the tabernacle represent? God's presence, right? And so God's presence was supposed to be among them, right? And they were supposed to be surrounding God's presence is supposed to be among the people. But now, for this little portion of time, the tent is taken outside. Almost like, God's presence is not with you right now because you've broken the covenant. It's kind of a sign there. And Moses is pleading for the Lord to forgive him. And he also is kind of questioning whether he should leave these people. And God assures him that his presence is going to go before him. And he does show him his glory. Moses is told by God that he cannot see God's face, but that he will, God will hold him in the cleft of the rock, and he'll see the back parts as he goes by. Now, earlier on, it's interesting, in chapter 33, verse 11 says that God spoke with Moses face to face, but here in Exodus 33 and verse 20, it says that no man shall see my face and live. How do we reconcile those? Is there a problem there?
Spoke to Moses face to face in the sense of spoke to him directly.
Yeah, it's just a figure of speech to talk about the intimacy of the conversation. It was a direct communication, and this is talking about seeing God's glory, right? And of course, God doesn't have a literal face or an arm or hands or anything like that. But nobody can look upon the full glory of God. That's what he's saying. Now, Moses, I suppose, saw as much glory as he could without dying here. But by that, he is reassured that he is to lead the people, and God is being merciful, really, to Moses. He says, "I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy," and then he shows him his glory, and that's the context in which that is spoken in. So that's those two things there. And so in chapter 34, God then begins to renew the covenant with his people. Now, he knew that Israel was going to disobey at certain points. I mean, in chapter 32, he called them a stiff-necked people. But at the same time, the Lord did have compassion on them. There's one other thing I wanted us to notice. It says here with their sin that the Lord repented. And the idea of the Lord repenting is not that he changed his mind or backed up, but the fact that he had compassion on the people. So even back here, God is having compassion on them by still bringing them into the land and giving them the second chance, right, with the covenant. And so we go into chapter 34, and he tells Moses to make a second set of the tables of stone. You know, it's interesting to me that the tables were broken the first time. Maybe significant. Maybe the fact that the covenant had been broken, right? That all, you know, if you're going to commit idolatry, you've broken the whole thing. James 2, verse 10 says, if you offend in one point, you're guilty of all. So Moses, obviously angry, had done that. But Moses is told to fashion another set of tables of stone and to bring them up to the Lord, and the Lord's going to write to him these commandments a second time. And so God has some memorials that he wants them to remember, and there are some things repeated here in Exodus 34 that kind of remind us about or show Israel what they were to do when they were brought into the land. First of all, what was their reaction supposed to be with their interaction with the people when they went into the land of Canaan? Were they supposed to mingle with them?
No,
destroy it, right? I mean, if they're having trouble with idolatry here when they're by themselves, certainly that's going to be a snare to them. That's going to be a thorn in their side if they get too friendly with the other people and start intermarrying. And that's exactly what happened. They didn't destroy all of the people that they were supposed to when they get into the land. And the book of Judges shows us how again and again they were making mistakes because they didn't drive out all the people that the Lord had told them to drive out. Now, he also gives them some memorials here. He talks about the feasts. You should have at the very last page of the last handout I gave you last week, a summary of the Jewish feasts. Feast of the Passover, also known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread, was a feast that commemorated them coming out of the land of Egypt. The fact that they didn't use leaven showed that they came out with haste. And you remember God waited for years and years and years to bring them out, but when God said it was time to go, right? And if you were an Israelite living there in Egypt, you probably would have thought, how long is it going to be before Pharaoh lets us go? But when God decides that the fullness of time has come, he doesn't have to be slow about doing something. He can, you know, whenever it's right on his calendar, he can do it. So the deliverance there, the Passover, the atonement that's made, Feast of Pentecost, also known as the Feast of Weeks, it was, they would count seven Sabbaths after the Passover, and then one day after that, and it was always on the first day of the week, of course, when the church was established. Also called the Feast of Harvest, the Feast of First Fruits, and then the Feast of Tabernacles, also called the Feast of Booths. 7 days the people dwelt in booths and made branches to commemorate them wandering through the wilderness there. And so three times they were to appear before the Lord at Jerusalem. And here's something I want us to consider. Verse 24, I know I've mentioned this before in Bible classes and in sermons. It's interesting to me. It says, I will cast out the nations before thee and enlarge thy borders. Neither shall any man desire thy land when thou shalt go up to appear before the Lord thy God thrice in a year. I just think this is a fascinating verse to consider. Because if you think about a command where God is having all the males come three times out of the year to Jerusalem, and even when the harvest is there, you know, they're leaving their fields, they're leaving their wives, they're leaving their children, and they're all appearing at one place. If you were an enemy of Israel, what would be a prime time to take over people's farms and lands? Right. And what does God say here? He says, if you honor me this way in the feast, he says, no man will desire your land. Now, how does God do that? I don't know. How does God make people not desire the land? I don't know, but God says they won't desire it. And so that's just, it's an interesting thing. I think that's a good testament to God's providence, that He can take care of people if they'll follow Him. And I can't find any record in the Old Testament where somebody came in and took over Israel during one of the feast days when they were trying to serve God faithfully. Now, many times they didn't observe the feast the way they ought to have, but if they were faithfully serving God and they were there down for a feast, I don't remember any time, and maybe you can think of one, where they were attacked by an enemy during those times. So that just seems to me to be a fascinating verse on God's protection and His care for His people. So we also have the Sabbath, which was a reminder of them, the rest that they were going to be given, and the fact that they were supposed to set aside a time to think of God each week. And so there were some memorials here that God had given him. And is it any wonder why God gave them memorials? Because what had they done just in 40 days? They've forgotten God, right? They were quick to forget. Now, the last part here of Exodus 34, we have Moses, after he goes in and speaks to the Lord, and then he comes out and talks to the people, his face is shining, right? And so what does he do? What does it say that he does? He puts a veil on his face. And the interesting thing is that in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul makes an application along this line. And he talks about a veil not on the face, but a veil on what?
The heart.
The heart. So, apparently the Jews, had the veil on their heart even up to the time that Paul was writing, which was why they did not accept what God was saying about the Messiah, they except Jesus Christ. They still had that veil on their heart. Verses 7 through 18 talks about the glory of the New Testament, how it's even greater than the Old Testament glory. And there's still that veil on the people's hearts so that they don't see what God would have them to see. But I think here in the Old Testament, I mean, obviously New Testament, they were using some plain speech, but I think here in the Old Testament, don't you think it was a sign of the fact that God was speaking with Moses? You know, remember they were afraid, right, to look on his face. And so it made them trust more in what Moses was saying, because they weren't going to have God speak directly to them, but when Moses was speaking for them, and appearing in the presence of God for them, whenever he came out, it shone brightly before them. And they were afraid of the fact. And so it was a reminder that Moses was actually in the presence of God, and that, you know, he was to be feared. And it was something to hold in high regard. Chapter 35, we have some more Sabbath regulations. But then we, in chapter 35, we start to get into some of the preparations for the tabernacle. Now, the materials that they got for the tabernacle, how were they to get these materials? They're free will offerings, right? That's the way they were to get the materials for the tabernacle. And so it kind of describes here the different things they're supposed to get. And so they're commanded to do that. Now, in chapter 36, at the beginning of chapter 36, we have two men which are called of God in order to make these different elements in the tabernacle. Bezalel is mentioned, and Aholiab, I guess that's how you say his name. They're both mentioned as people that are going to be craftsmen to work in these areas in order to make these things for the tabernacle. Now, when they bring the stuff for the tabernacle, when the people actually present their offerings, in chapter 36 here, how was the outcome of it? They brought more than what was needed. Isn't that a good problem to have? We have too much. Stop giving. Do you think we have that problem with the Lord's church any? I don't know.
It depends.
Yeah.
Not very often.
Maybe, you know, you've had a food or a clothing drive or something like that where people bring too much. But they brought more than enough. They had to even command them to stop. So many times we look at the mistakes of these people and their shortcomings, but I think it's good for us to look at some good points of them too, right? They brought more than enough for the tabernacle. Now, the tabernacle has been assembled here in chapter 36. It's starting to be built. And then God goes over again the items that are to be found in the tabernacle, and they actually carry them out. Last time it was more of an instruction. This time they're actually building these things and putting them together and placing them in these different parts. And I have my cable this week, so I'm very excited to show you guys.
Where'd you find it, by the way?
It was in the sound room. You know, I think maybe that's why God went over this twice, so that I would have a second chance to deliver it to you guys. Here's the tabernacle, and it, of course, was the place where they would worship, and outside you see the altar there, and you see the bronze laver that was between the altar and the tabernacle. And like Tom mentioned last week, there are some deep things in this that are very significant that I don't know if I grasped. In a lot of ways, I don't feel like I'm up to the task of trying to explain all of them, but I wish I knew more about these. But looking at some of these, we looked last week at the covering they were supposed to give, that they were supposed to donate. The first one was this fine twined linen of blue, scarlet, and purple. The second one was the white goat's hair. Third one was the red dyed ram skins, and then the badger skins went over the top. And so it was a very well covered tent that they set up each place that they went. The next thing that's described here is the Ark of the Covenant. This was the only piece of furniture in what? The most holy place, which was a perfect cube. It contained what? Does anybody remember?
Tablets of stone.
Bowl of manna.
And there's a bowl of manna. Interesting that the manna there, their continual dependence on God from day to day. So the top of it was called the mercy seat, and God said that that's where I will meet with you. And so it was, in a sense, representative of heaven, or meeting God with heaven. And you know, when Hebrews 9 talks about Jesus and his sacrifice, when he made an atonement for the sins of the people, he didn't go into the most holy place made with hands, but where did he go? Into heaven itself, right? So, where God meets with man, and Jesus' sacrifice, certainly some significance there with the Ark of the Covenant, and Jesus going into heaven. Next, we have the table of showbread. You remember, as you entered into the tabernacle, it would be to the right. The tabernacle faced east, so it would be to the north, if you all can visualize that. I don't know how good you guys are at directions, but I've become worse since I've come here at directions. I think it's these curvy roads. I don't know. Anyway, they would eat the old bread, and they would put the new bread out. 12 loaves representing the 12 tribes of Israel would be placed there on the table of showbread. They would, I guess they would also bring their sacrifices there. The golden candlestick, pure olive oil, filled those 7 bowls. And, I'm sure that our pictures of it and what our artists do are nothing compared to the way that Bezalel and Aholiab did these things. Anyway, it was on the other side as you entered in. It was in the left, the opposite side, and it was to be burning continually. The light was to be there. Representative of God's Word being a light to us, and it's found in the tabernacle. We talked last week about how somebody would wash and put on new garments, their priestly garments, before they go into the tabernacle to officiate. And so it is with us. We are clothed with Christ in baptism. We wash and are clothed with Christ in baptism. Then we go into the church in order to be priests unto God. 2 Peter 3 talks about that. Now, going on, the altar of incense was right before the veil. You know, as you went in, it was straight ahead of you, and it was right in front of that curtain that separated the holy place from the most holy place. And atop it was a square cubit, and had some horns on the corners that blood was put on. It was placed right there before the veil. And as Tom mentioned last week, the incense, Revelation 5 talks about the incense being the prayers of the saints. It would pour over that veil into the most holy place, which, if that represented heaven, you know, the prayers going up and being heard in God's presence. And then there is the anointing oil and incense. Here you have the different ingredients that were given for them. So God's giving very specific instructions for every single one of these, and they're to be followed out. There's a pattern that's to be followed. And it's interesting that as you look at the church, the pattern should be followed as well. We'll talk about that in just a minute. The altar of burnt offering, all the animal sacrifices were offered upon it. There was daily sacrifice in the morning and in the evening. One lamb in the morning, one lamb in the evening. Besides all the other sacrifices that might have been offered on there. And that stood out outside the tabernacle, obviously. Then there's that brazen laver, the bronze laver that we talked about, that the priest would wash in before they would enter into the tabernacle. But in talking about the tabernacle and the church, it's interesting. God had a pattern for everything that he wanted in the tabernacle. And, you know, Acts 7 talks about how God was going to raise a new tabernacle. And Hebrews chapter 9 talks about how Jesus is over a more perfect tabernacle. And so if the church is God's more perfect tabernacle, does God have a pattern for the church? What are some verses you can think about that show that God has a pattern for the church? Acts 2:42, right? They continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and in fellowship, breaking of bread and prayers, right? Paul talks about how, you know, we all have to walk according to the same rule. You know, if anybody doesn't follow this rule, or Romans 6, verse 17, talks about a form of doctrine. What does that mean? A pattern of teaching. And when you go through the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, there, Romans 6, baptism. So there's a pattern of teaching. There's a pattern to be followed even in the church. And so it's interesting how God prescribed all those things for the Old Testament, and here he's done it for the New Testament. He has a certain pattern that we want to need to follow. Some people scoff at pattern, following a pattern, but that's exactly what the people of God have always been required to do, right? Follow exactly what God has given. Now, these garments for the priesthood are listed here. And as we pointed out last week, there was the breastplate. Contained those precious stones, 12 stones, representing the 12 tribes of Israel. On top there were, you know, their names were engraved, 6 on each stone on the top. The ephod was the sleeveless garment that was worn under breastplate. Looked kind of like probably some sort of apron, maybe. Probably, obviously, went around the back, but it was sleeveless. And then there was a robe that went underneath that, and on the bottom there were bells and pomegranates on there. So I guess you could hear them walking into the place when they were officiating. There is a broidered coat worn under the robe. And then the mitre was a turban on the head with the gold plate that said what? Holiness to the Lord, right? And then there was a girdle, which was a sash that was worn, same design as the ephod. And here's kind of a representation of that. See the incense that they would have. Here's the coat. Here's the robe. Here's the ephod. And the sash or the girdle of the same type. Here's the different stones and the breastplate, and there's the mitre and the plate on the front that said holiness to the Lord. Certainly a very reverent dress, right? Reverential dress. And then we find that everything is arranged in the tabernacle here. Of course, in the Holy of Holies, we have the Ark of the Covenant. Like I said, the Ark, the altar of incense was right before the veil. On the right was the lampstand. On the right was the table of showbread. On the left was the lampstand. Outside the tabernacle, we had the brazen or bronze laver, and then the altar. There was also some provisions given for the outer court and how big it was supposed to be and the materials given for that. So the tabernacle is finally pitched and arranged in chapter 40. Everything's put into its place. And then notice that in chapter 40, we find that God's presence is found with the people. Now, it's interesting. Here's what I was getting at earlier. Back when Moses had pitched that tent outside of the camp, the presence of God was kind of outside because they hadn't renewed the covenant yet. Now that God has renewed the covenant with them and they've built these things, in chapter 40, right here at the end, beginning at verse 34, we have the glory of the Lord filling the place. It says, "The cloud covered the tent of the congregation. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, and Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation because the cloud abode thereon, and the glory filled the tabernacle. When the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the children of Israel went onward on all their journeys. But if the cloud were not taken up, then they journeyed not till the day it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was upon the tabernacle by day, and fire was on it by night, and the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys." So from then on, they followed that cloud. Wherever it moved, they would pack up and they would move. And that's how God would guide them through the wilderness. Any questions that we have on the book of Exodus before we stop for this evening?
An interesting observation. Quite a few years ago, we were living in Colorado, and the Mormons had built a tabernacle in Denver. And before it was sanctified and they allowed people to come in and tour through it, unclean Gentiles were allowed to come tour through. And we got to the room where they did baptisms. And I almost laughed out loud because their baptismal thing had 12 half-heads all the way around representing the 12 tribes of Israel. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Didn't God say, don't do this? And so, I mean, they have little regard for the Bible anyway, but, you know, it just was, I thought, quite ironic that...
Didn't the Solomon's Temple have that, though? On the laver? I think they put it on the 12 cattle. Anyway, obviously the Mormons don't, you know, I'm not trying to take up for them or anything, but it's interesting.
It was neat to see it, though, I'll tell you right now.
Yeah.
It was interesting to see.
So we end the book of Exodus with, the Lord still leading his people, even though they've sinned, and he's had compassion on them and forgiven them, and they're able to go on. And Moses is shown to be a great leader. Exodus is very varied. A lot of different things we could have considered in it. And just so much material. There was some stuff I wanted to get to, but I didn't want to press through a bunch of things and get confused myself. So next week we will cover the whole book of Leviticus in 1 week. So I hope hope you guys are ready for that. I have to go at breakneck pace with this class. So you guys get ready for Leviticus. We'll do that next week. We'll put a peg down right there and... allow you to stretch your leg before Tom gets up.